Alaska Public Media presents Debate for the State. And now your moderator, Lori Townsend.
Good evening and welcome to Debate for the State, the last statewide debate of this busy election season. I'm Lori Townsend, news director for Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Public Radio Network. We're coming to you live from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage. Tonight's program, however, is a collaboration of all the Alaska Public Broadcasting stations. Our guests are candidates for Lieutenant Governor who have registered at least 5% in recent political polls. Both are lifelong Alaskans. Byron Malott is a candidate for the non-affiliated ticket with Bill Walker. Mr. Malott comes from Southeast Alaska. He has been Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the Sea Alaska Corporation, Mayor of Yakutat, and briefly, Mayor of Juneau. Mr. Malott also is a past president of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Welcome, Mr. Malott.
Thank you.
Dan Sullivan is mayor of Anchorage and running on the Republican ticket with Governor Sean Parnell. Mr. Sullivan served 9 years on the Anchorage Assembly before being elected mayor. He is an Anchorage business owner and has been director of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Welcome. Joining me on our news panel is Alexandra Gutierrez, state capitol correspondent for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alexandra. And Ben Matheson. Ben is a news reporter for KYUK Public Radio in Bethel. Now for the rules of the debate. Candidates, we have several segments in our program tonight, ranging from your style as Lieutenant Governor to the economic future of Alaska. Each question will be timed. You will see a yellow light letting you know that you have a few seconds to complete your answer. When you hear this bell, the time is up. I will enforce this as politely as possible. Now let's begin. We tossed a coin earlier, and Mayor Dan Sullivan won the right to answer our first question, and that will be asked by Ben Matheson. You will have 45 seconds to respond.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, when you look past over this past year of campaigning, is there one moment on the trail that encapsulates your bid for statewide office?
Probably not one moment, but a series of moments, because quite frankly, I had not been to many of our smaller communities in a long, long time. I traveled through Southeast, and I went to Ketchikan, Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, hopped over to Kodiak, up to Nome. Just, you know, a lot of places that, because you get caught in your own little world, you don't have that experience. And it was really refreshing to revisit small-town Alaska, see what their issues are. And the main thing I found as I traveled around was it was just good to listen. You know, I could tell them about what I stood for, what my record was, but the most important thing was to listen to the people in these communities and what their concerns are. I think that was the best moment.
And Ms. Merlot, is there one moment on the campaign trail that encapsulates your campaign?
Well, certainly, like Dan, traveling the state, meeting people, meeting old friends, and making new. But I can't help but state that I walked into what I thought was a fundraiser, greeting everyone, looked over my shoulder, and I had inadvertently walked into Uncle Will's 90th birthday party. And he greeted me as if I were an invited guest, offered me a piece of cake, and then later his daughter showed me down the road to where I was supposed to be. It was a wonderful moment.
Alexander Gutierrez will have our next question for Byron Malott. Mr. Malott, you will have 45 seconds to answer.
Mr. Malott, you won the Democratic nomination for governor. Now you've joined the independent ticket along with Bill Walker, running in the second spot as lieutenant governor. What should the 42,000 Alaskans who voted for you as a Democrat during the primary think of your decision to run on a more politically viable ticket?
I think the reality is already known. There has been strong positive reaction to our ticket. I clearly wanted the Democratic Party to join and support my effort, and in a vote of 89-2 by the State Democratic Central Committee, they did so, and I've had nothing but just constant reassurance that this was the right decision for Alaska and for my campaign.
Mr. Sullivan, you've regularly sparred with organized labor as Anchorage's mayor. And on Tuesday, you'll see a referendum for Anchorage Ordinance 37, which curtails labor rights for public employees. If elected lieutenant governor, how would you envision your relationship with organized labor? And would you push AO 37 to the rest of the state?
I don't think as lieutenant governor you really have that role, quite frankly. It's not in the prescribed duties as lieutenant governor. Certainly the governor, if he wanted to lead a charge of revamping labor laws, that would be more in the governor's seat. But keep in mind that in my relationship with labor, we just completed our seventh contract out of our nine union groups. That the tenets of AO 37 are virtually contained in every single contract, basically negotiated by their leaders, ratified by their members. So if AO 37 was so horrible as they claim, again, we've passed seven contracts with AO 37 provisions in all of them. So it really is less contentious than it is kind of about a power grab.
Much of Alaska has been built by men and women belonging to labor unions, including the oil industry. With falling oil prices, the state is expected to experience a shortfall within the coming year. Let's go now to a few questions about Alaska's major economy. In this section, candidates will have 1 minute to respond. Ben, you will have our next question to Mr. Sullivan.
With oil down to nearly $80 a barrel, do you think the levels of taxation on other sectors of the economy are appropriate for this time?
I don't think that you can really tax your way out of economic downturns. The best thing you can do is stimulate an economy. As mayor, I faced this very same challenge when I came into office in 2009. The city of Anchorage had previously made what I thought was a terrible mistake. They dramatically increased the cost of government at a time when revenues were falling. And we got through that by not increasing taxes, but by becoming a more efficient organization. At the state level, you need to do the same thing, but you also need to grow your way out of economic downturn, and you don't do that by taxes. Taxes slow economic growth. So no, I wouldn't see increasing taxes on other entities.
What level of deficit spending are you comfortable with, given these oil prices?
Oh, it's hard to throw a number at it because we don't know if the prices are going to maintain. It's a very volatile commodity market. We've seen it shift up to $10 in a given day sometimes. So hard to throw a number at it. But the bottom line is you want to get to a sustainable budget where you're not reaching into your savings account. At the city level, I've had to do that with every single budget. Our budgets have to balance. That would be the goal at the state level as well.
And Mr. Merlot, are taxes on other parts of the economy appropriate given today's oil prices?
Oh, certainly. The notion, again, that we can tax our way either to balancing budgets or to prosperity has been shown never to work in an economy. The economy needs to be stimulated across the board. The state, through smart judgments about infrastructure development, appropriate incentives, even in a strapped state budget circumstance. If we're smart and if we are thoughtful, we can grow the entire economy.
Mr. Malat, you recently said SB 21, the law that caps oil taxes at a rate of 35%, is performing better at current oil prices. How much time should the law be given before its performance is judged as working better than anything before? And what metrics would you use?
Well, anecdotally, certainly, we need to see continuing growth in expenditure in production activity on the North Slope by the three major oil companies, increase in workforce, ultimately an increase in throughput of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. That will take several years, and I think we need to see what that does make possible.
Mr. Malat, you campaigned against SB 21. If the repeal referendum were held today, how would you vote?
I didn't vote so much against the tax itself, but the fact that we had to vote on it at all. It was a failure, in my judgment, of leadership at the legislative level, at the administration level, that Alaskans weren't fully prepared or knowledgeable of the tax, which was evidenced by the very repeal effort itself.
And Mr. Malat, yes or no then? How would you vote if the primary were held again today?
I would vote yes.
And Mr. Sullivan, how much time do you think the law should be given before we judge its performance, and what metrics would you use?
Sure. Well, I was on your radio component here a couple of days ago with Zach, and I told him 36 months, so I better stay consistent and stay the same. About a 3-year period where you can really see whether or not the incentives are increasing production, whether or not the activity that we've seen on the North Slope now, which is very vigorous. In fact, there's hundreds of new jobs. Point Thompson alone, I think about 1,000 people working where nobody was working before. So about 36 months. And let's face it, the state has never been shy about changing the oil regime if it turns out that it's not working or that we're not getting the promises kept that were made in the passage of SB 21. And just to follow up on the second half of your question, you know, the legislature passed SB 21. There was no reason for it to go to a referendum. In fact, the referendum started within days after the passage, not even giving it a chance to work. I thought that was very premature, probably a misuse of the referendum process, quite frankly.
We'll come back to some fiscal reality questions later, but first we want to talk about the role of Alaska's lieutenant governor. Alexander Gutierrez has the next question to Mr. Malott. You will have 1 minute to respond.
Mr. Malott, if elected lieutenant governor, you would be in an office that oversees elections, the state seal, and notaries public. In discussions with Mr. Walker about the joint ticket, what level of independence and responsibility did you require?
Well, certainly the governor is the constitutional administrative leader, executive leader of our state, and I have every confidence that Mr. Walker is going to do a wonderful job. I will be a senior advisor to the governor. I will be a member of the cabinet. I will be able to advise on major policy issues, but I also have constitutional duties, and I will be able to and anxious to meet every single one of those, but I look forward to a robust involvement with the policy evolution of the state of Alaska.
And were there any sort of, hard lines for you in terms of what role you had in
quite frankly, I did have several people advise that I put my relationship in writing with the governor, and I said, that is just crazy. You know, you have to trust, you have to work together. The offices are constitutionally mandated, and their responsibilities are very clear, and I look forward to advising the governor in every way that it is possible for me to do so.
Mr. Sullivan, in the current administration, there's been some pushback from Governor Parnell against Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell for operating too independently. What agreements, if any, do you have with Governor Parnell for your role within his administration?
Well, none at all. I mean, our conversations have been really focused on the campaign, how our philosophies are very, very similar. I'm fortunate in the fact that during my 5.5 years as mayor, it pretty much parallels Governor Parnell's term as governor since he took over from Sarah Palin. So we've gotten to know each other. We work together on capital budgets, on operating budget issues that are important to Anchorage. I know all of his commissioners, and I have a good working relationship with all of them. So there's no defined extra role. But again, the lieutenant governor is a member of the cabinet, as Byron mentioned. You're sitting at that table when policy's being made. Given the experience that I bring to that table, I'd like to think that I could be an effective voice for making sure that we do enact effective policies that will enhance opportunity for Alaska.
The major responsibility of the lieutenant governor is overseeing the Division of Elections. Mr. Malott, do you think the federal court was correct in ordering the state to take specific steps to improve Alaska Native language translation and services at the polls?
I believe it was, absolutely. And obviously, I will enforce them, and I will continue to work as lieutenant governor to make sure that voting opportunities are made available to every Alaskan in the most efficient and expeditious way possible.
And Mr. Sullivan, do you support the court order requiring more services to be given to Alaska Native voters?
I agree with my friend Byron Malott that the court has ordered, and I think even without the court order, it was the right thing to do.
Mr. Sullivan, as Lieutenant Governor, would you have certified the Walker-Malott ticket? Why or why not?
I think a clear reading of the law says that it's just vague enough in some areas where the ticket is allowed under our current statutes and under the Constitution. So, yes, I think I would have done the same thing that Mead Treadwell did and have that ticket move forward. I know there's been some discussion that in the future maybe that should be tightened up a little bit because people ask the legitimate question of what is the use of a primary if it can just be taken apart by a whim or by political convenience. And so, particularly since the state pays for primaries, again, it seems like maybe we're wasting money if it really has no meaning, if people can just for convenience change it.
Mr. Malott, would you have certified your ticket?
Absolutely. Okay. In a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly it was a step that was taken very deliberatively. I did not leave my principles at the door. I worked very hard to get the support of the Democratic Party as I made the decision. I believe that the result of our coming together and what is popularly called, not named by us, the unity ticket has been validated by the incredible response across the state, and it was the right thing to do for Alaska.
Does that undermine the primary process, though, if those campaigns and those voters go out to vote?
This was a unique circumstance. It was a very personally difficult decision for me to make. I would not have made it if the party itself, as it did in a vote of 89-2 of its central committee, did not allow me to do so.
As Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Malott, you would be responsible for certifying ballot initiatives. Should issues that are usually under the purview of state agencies, such as the development of large-scale mines, be subject to the initiative process?
I don't think, as a general proposition, that relatively detailed public policy should be made through the initiative process. It is there in order to give voters a voice where they believe that their voice is not being heard. So it is a very precious tool in our Constitution. But I think it should be very carefully and not often used.
But as Lieutenant Governor, you often would see ballot initiatives, regardless of whether how complicated they are or not, would their complexity bear on your decision to certify them?
Oh, I think the requirement to certify is fairly circumscribed by law and likely by regulation. And I'm not sure that the Lieutenant Governor has a lot of subjective opportunity to make those judgments.
And Mr. Sullivan, do you think that issues that are usually left to the judgment of state agencies should be subject of ballot initiatives, for example, the development of large-scale mines?
Yeah, I concur that I think complicated issues like that, where the public does not have the opportunity to sit in many, many in detail meetings like the legislature does, where you're getting expert testimony, you're getting all the technical information, that's oftentimes not available to the public. So trying to ask them to weigh in on very, very complicated issues, I think, is problematic. But was mentioned, the role of the Lieutenant Governor isn't to put your own feelings into these. In fact, you have to be very objective, make sure you're following the letter of the law when you're looking at initiatives, were the signatures gathered from the right areas, is there enough signatures, is the heading and the topic written within the prescribes of the law. So that's what you have to focus on as Lieutenant Governor.
And Mr. Malott, should professional signature gatherers have a place in the initiative process? Should outside groups be involved at all?
Well, I don't think that outside groups, that is outside of our state, we do have a requirement that a certain number be gathered in various regions of the state so that the work of particularly professional or paid signature gatherers requires them at the very least to travel the state, but I don't think much of the notion. It is a citizen effort, and to the maximum degree possible should remain a citizen effort.
And Mr. Sullivan, what do you believe the place of professional signature gatherers and separately outside groups is in the initiative process?
Well, it's clearly allowed. So, until somebody changes the law, it is what it is. It's when you compare it to what's going on with campaigns anyway, with all the money that comes in both from in-state and out-of-state, saying that people who want to use the legislative process from the initiative or referendum standpoint can't avail themselves of that same sort of professional service, I think would be really drawing a line that you can do it here if you're in a campaign, but if you're a citizen trying to get action done, you can't do it. And again, the law says you can.
Mr. Sullivan, what do you think qualifies you to run the Division of Elections, and how has your work as mayor prepared you for that job?
Yeah, thank you. A great question. I think, when you're the mayor of the largest city in Alaska, which is 300,000 plus people now, You're managing a workforce that covers almost every single entity that's similar in state government. You've got a public safety department. You've got a public works department. You've got a park and recreation department, a health and human services department. So as the CEO of all those functions, and you know, obviously we have local elections as well, but those aren't under the purview of the mayor. Those are under the purview of the clerk. But again, that management experience of literally handling the CEO duties of the largest city in the state for the last 5.5 years, I think handling the one function of the Division of Elections is certainly within my skill set and something that I would be looking forward to do, because I want to look at modernizing. It's my understanding that some of our equipment is getting aged. There's some new technology out there. I'd look forward to that challenge.
Would you see yourself as a manager? Is that a position you'd use to describe yourself in that Division of Elections position?
Well, I think one of the best things you can do as a CEO is delegate to good managers and find the best people you can possibly find to perform those various roles, whether it's elections, whether it's reviewing regulations, which is another one of the duties of the lieutenant governor. Hire good people, give them good, clear direction, set the policy, and then if you find that things aren't performing well, get in there and make the corrections.
Mr. Malott, what qualifies you to run the Division of Elections, and how has your time as mayor, I guess, informed that?
Well, both... not particularly my service as mayor. My modern service was as the mayor of Juneau, where I served for 6 months. But as a former cabinet officer, having run a department of state government in my career as a business person, as a CEO, as the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, I think that I have the requisite qualifications to manage and oversee the Division of Elections.
And you use the term CEO and manager. Are those the qualities that you would bring to that job?
Yes, because as Mayor Sullivan has said, a large part of good management is the ability to delegate, to have clear terms, to have responsibility and be able to act when responsibility is not being met.
Mr. Malott, how much independence do you plan to give the division of the director of the Division of Elections?
The director of a significant division in state government has meaningful and clearly defined responsibilities, and I would allow the individual to work in the best way possible within his or her framework of management. I would exact clear accountability and make sure that the responsibilities were fully met. And if that were the result, I would give discretion and clear responsibility to that individual.
And Mr. Sullivan, how much autonomy would you plan to give the director of the Division of Elections?
It's such an important function, maybe one of the most important functions in our democracy, that while you want to make sure that you've got a good manager and you don't micromanage, at the same time, given the importance of that job and that role, I think that's the one thing that as Lieutenant Governor I would keep a keen eye on at all times to make sure that there's absolutely nothing that could ever be criticized, that elections were unfair, that for some reason the implementation of elections around this big old state of ours was not done efficiently. So I think that's one area where, yes, I'd hire the best person I could for the job, but I'd keep a keen eye on all the performance of that job.
If you're just tuning in, thank you for joining us for Debate for the State for Lieutenant Governor with Republican candidate Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan and Byron Malott, the non-affiliated candidate. Now we are going to allow the candidates to ask questions of each other. Please keep your questions succinct to about 20 seconds, and you will have 1 minute for your response with a 30-second rebuttal if you so choose. Mr. Malott, you may ask the first question.
Okay. I'd like to ask Mayor Sullivan, my friend Dan, what is your sense of the current state of the state of Alaska's relationship with rural Alaska, particularly remote Alaska?
You know, that is a great question, because I think that's been a challenge as we've become a state. 55 years ago, developing and nurturing that relationship with our first people in rural Alaska. And we have to keep in mind that it's not just Native Alaskans in rural Alaska. There's a whole group of folks that over the years have called rural Alaska their home. But I think under the Parnell administration, I think we've seen some historical strides. You know, he's doubled the number of VPSOs out in rural Alaska because public safety is job number one. I think his initiatives on career training so that folks in rural Alaska who maybe not are all on a college career path have an opportunity to get a good job when they get out of high school and even get some of that training while they're in high school. I think as we look at some of the other initiatives with energy in rural Alaska, the Alaska Energy Authority has done a great job mapping potential energy projects, and we're starting to implement many of those, whether it's river hydro, whether it's wind. So I think the relationship is getting stronger and stronger.
Would you like a 30-second rebuttal?
Well, certainly there is currently significant tension in the state of Alaska's administration of programs and policy in rural Alaska. There is a sense that there is not the kind of equality in the level of services, in the delivery of constitutionally mandated responsibilities in education and justice, and public safety. So I think we have much to do.
Mr. Sullivan, now you may ask a question of Mr. Malott. Again, please keep your question succinct, about 20 seconds. You will have 1 minute to respond.
Yes, thank you. And again, I appreciated you saying your friend Dan and to my friend Byron. One of the things that I guess troubles me about the ticket is that I look at your resume, you know, CEO of the Permanent Fund, a state commissioner, CEO of a major Native corporation, a former mayor. How come you're not at the head of the ticket? I look at your resume versus Mr. Walker, who, you know, a great guy, a good lawyer, but never the level of management and overall performance and skills that you possess in your resume. How come you're not at the top of that ticket?
I came to know Bill Walker during the course of essentially a year-long campaign. And I just became really like I wanted to be the kind of person that had the passion he had for our state. I certainly have a passion, a powerful passion, but I believe he really is a leader. I believe that that he can take our state into the future by reaching out to Alaskans, by, as he says, having a cup of coffee with someone to begin a conversation about a very difficult issue as opposed to filing a lawsuit, by being a decent man who can really connect with Alaskans and earn their trust and work to make Alaska better as a result of the relationships that he establishes with them.
Mr. Sullivan, would you like 30 seconds to respond to that?
Well, just again, I've got a lot of respect for Byron Malott and what he's accomplished in his career, his advocacy for Native Alaskans over the course of many decades. And I just see that as being the kind of qualifications, you know, talk about mending relationships with rural Alaska. You, as the head of the ticket and you know, an opportunity to become governor, I think would have been historic in so many ways. And you know, Mr. Walker's been working on a pipeline for 30 years, he says, and nobody's seen a pipeline. So I just don't know that there's that that level of accomplishment that says he should be the next governor. I'd rather have seen you at the top of the ticket.
We'll be working very closely together.
Okay.
Mr. Malott, we have time for you to ask a second question. Again, same rules apply. Please keep your question succinct. And Mr. Sullivan, you'll have a minute to respond.
Yeah. As a, obviously, you will be a senior policy advisor to the governor if elected. What is your thinking as to the state's role in labor relations with state governmental employees and its relationships with labor as involved with state contracts and so forth?
I think as we've shown in Anchorage, one of the things that we want to make sure we achieve is balance. What we saw in 2008 in Anchorage, of course, were the richest contracts in Anchorage history in the midst of the worst recession in 70 years. People in the private sector losing their jobs, certainly not getting raises year after year after year. So that's what you have to do with labor, whether it's at the state level or the local level. Find that balance and make sure that the people who were responsible for paying for labor contracts, which in our case, you know, isn't individual income tax, but it is still taxes, basically that they're treated fairly and that wages and benefits given to the labor groups do not exceed standards in the private sector. And in Anchorage, certainly they vastly exceeded during those 2008 contracts. So I think just trying to find that balance. You know, I have a lot of respect for public employees. They do a lot of hard work, particularly our public safety folks. And I've never denigrated a public employee, but you have to find that balance and you have to be fair.
Would you like to respond?
I think the reality is that in the municipality of Anchorage, there are, again, tensions with organized labor. Hearing that the mayor in state government would work to create balance is welcome news.
Mr. Sullivan, do you have a second question for Mr. Millett?
I was kind of debating what to ask Byron, because oftentimes people try and get into gotcha moments when you ask questions. But I was intrigued by the Sarah Palin endorsement, and the endorsement, like the next day, the spokesperson for the campaign said it's a partial endorsement. What is a partial Palin endorsement? Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, or how does that work?
I think that the reality of it is that, you know, she is a person whom you either like a lot or you don't. But she is a thought leader. She is a galvanizing personality across this country. The way I would put it is the way the Fairbanks Newsminer put it. They said Mr. Millett and Sarah Palin stood side by side, but it was clear they didn't have their arms around one another, and I'll leave it at that.
Would you like to respond, 30 seconds?
Well, I just don't understand how you can partially endorse a candidacy. You're either endorsing and you put your full weight and commitment behind your support for the Walker Millett team, or you don't. It seems like it's somewhere in the middle. I don't get it, quite frankly.
We are going to move back to some questions about Alaska's fiscal reality. Oil revenue is the main driver of the state's economy, and oil prices have fallen dramatically in recent months to currently around $80 per barrel. The state's budget is dependent on oil revenue. Alexander will begin this section on budgetary issues with a question about stability for education funding. Gentlemen, you have 1 minute to respond to this question.
Mr. Millett, given the current fiscal realities, what plan do you have for sustaining and improving the state school system?
First of all, we have to make clear that the state is in fiscal crisis. That doesn't mean we should panic, but we need to be very clear about the priorities that we establish. And funding our educational system and making it better is a high priority for the Walker Millett team. And it's not about, as many people often say, throwing money at it. It's about being very smart. It's about making sure that pre-kindergarten all the way through our university system with career training opportunities hopefully strengthened, that we are making investments that allow us to build a workforce for our future, that allow us to create leadership for our future, and really to give the opportunity of that magic moment between a teacher and a student to galvanize a relationship and begin moving a child into the future of our state. And we can do that without vastly increasing funding.
And just following that up on that point, Mr. Millett, the increase to the base student allocation, which is the per pupil funding,
yes,
that goes to schools, that was a huge topic of debate this past year. And while an increase was given, it wasn't to the extent the education advocates wanted. You said that could you be more specific on...
It was not even to the level that the legislature itself and the educational department said was the necessary level.
So,
and I think that we should get to that level, yes.
And that level being how much would you like to increase the base student allocation?
Being in the next budget to fully fund the base student allocation. Now, a caveat, as Dan has been careful to make, I am not the governor. I will be able to recommend to the governor, but he will make the final decision.
And Mr. Sullivan, given the current fiscal picture, what is your plan for the public school system?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the constitutional requirements that we fund education. What's interesting is when we use the term fully funding, what does that mean? Does that mean no matter what they ask, we give it? Or does it mean that we should take a look at what the results are from the money we're spending today and maybe think about a new way of delivering education? You know, right now we spend more per capita on students than anywhere in the nation, but we're last in the nation in fourth grade reading. We're near the bottom in eighth grade math, two key indicators of future success in life. So we have to take a whole new look at how we deliver education and not just how much money we put into education, because there's tons of money. So one of the things that I've suggested is while we still have billions of dollars in the bank, that we take some of that money, a couple hundred million dollars, for example, and create what I'm calling the Great Teacher Fund, where we encourage through paying college tuition of students in the top 5% of their class, if they will go into teaching, we will pay their entire college tuition. And we want them to get a master's degree in the subject they're teaching and a teaching degree. That's 8 years of college. And then when they go into the school system, they earn back that student loan by teaching for as many years as they used their college degree. This is what places like Singapore and Finland do. It's effective. A great teacher in every classroom is a huge, huge plus.
Mr. Sullivan, would you support any increase to the base student allocation?
You know, you look at it year by year. I just think that's one of those things that they need to come and present their case on how they're spending the money, but most importantly, what results are they getting from the spending? That wasn't even discussed in Juneau this last year. It was all about how much more money can we get. It should be about performance.
So you have no specific numbers in mind?
I don't think anybody has a specific number.
And Mr. Sullivan, against the backdrop of $80 a barrel oil, which State Department do you think has the most government waste and the most opportunity to cut costs?
Well, that's one of those things that when you get into government, that's what you analyze. When I became mayor, if somebody had asked me before you're mayor, where will you make your cuts, it's a little premature because you're not in that position. You're not there day to day doing that analysis. But I'll tell you where I'll start. I'll start with my own office because I think you need to lead by example. I did it as mayor, cut over $1 million out of the mayor's budget that Mayor Begich had had in his very highly staffed office. We cut our staff in half. You got to lead by example. That's where I'd start.
Are there things that you'd look at first in terms of policies, procedures,
sure,
staffing? What sort of things with that managerial mindset?
First, what you look at is what are your constitutional requirements? You have to satisfy those because that's the constitution of our state. After that, you then have a whole set of priorities that you can look at, but first you got to satisfy those constitutional priorities. After that, everything's on the table.
And there's not one department that stands out as you possibly prepare to look at those policies?
No, I think, again, a thoughtful approach to it isn't to single out one department or another when you're not even in the position yet, but to know that you're going in with the experience of having run a large government organization, successfully running a large government organization, and knowing that you can bring that skill to that same challenge at the state level.
Mr. Malott, is there one department that you think presents the biggest opportunity for saving costs?
Certainly the Health and Social Services Department is huge. The Department of Education is huge, but they are meeting constitutional mandates, so we have to be very careful and smart. But I believe that every bit of spending the state does should be on the table for careful analysis, for discussion, particularly by those who are most going to be affected by the decisions that we make, and take that knowledge and that experience to the legislature so that they also, and they have the constitutional responsibility to create a budget, or at least to create the appropriations that fund the budget. We will do it smartly.
So for a piece of state government that's not constitutionally mandated, constitutionally required, are there any areas that stand out?
I have to agree with Dan that we need to be in office. We need to have the information ourselves. We need to reach out to Alaskans in order to together do the analysis, do the hard discussions, and make the right decisions.
Alaska has long been holding on to the dream of developing a natural gas pipeline and the revenue that would come from it. And this is a question for both of you, but Mr. Malott, could you please describe your running mate's plan for developing a gas line?
He will finish the project of the liquefied natural gas plant and the construction of a large volume pipeline and in a responsible way, in an arm's length business relationship with the oil industry, in a transparent process with the people of our state, get our gas to market at the earliest possible time.
And Mr. Mullock, could you explain how that plan works?
Well, it is a very complex project. It is a long-term project. The process even to get to the final investment decision called the FID is at least 36 months away. And we have to be in office in order to fully understand what the entire process is. The legislature has been required to sign affidavits of confidentiality, and we would have to be in a circumstance to understand all that they know in order to make the right decisions.
And Mr. Sullivan, could you please describe your running mate's plan and how it works?
Sure. And this is really one of the reasons why changing administrations at this time is absolutely a big mistake, because there would be such a learning curve for a new administration to come in and get up to speed on all the historic progress that has been made to date. You've got a situation where there's alignment between the producers, alignment between the state of Alaska. You've got pre-FEED work going on, which is a lot of engineering. I'm more excited now about the prospects than I ever have been. I served for 7 years on the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority on the board. In that capacity, I probably learned as much as any human in the state about what it takes to be successful in developing a mega project like this. And I can tell you, of course, Mr. Mullock, Byron's running mate, Mr. Walker, is suing to stop Point Thompson. Point Thompson is key to a gas line. It's 8 trillion cubic feet of gas. There's 1,000 people working there today. If his suit is successful, those people are out of work and that project comes to a halt. That's key to a gas line. So keeping Governor Parnell's plan moving forward, keeping Point Thompson being developed, that's essential.
And could you just describe what that plan is? Give us the 30,000-foot view for people.
Sure. I mean, you've got a partnership between the big three producers, Conoco, Exxon, and BP, and the state of Alaska, with the state, with TransCanada, sharing about a 25% interest, sharing that risk with people with huge portfolios. Mr. Walker's proposed us taking a 50% ownership interest in it, which is a huge risk for the state of Alaska. It's much better to spread your risk amongst very, very solvent companies that can not only prove in their capacity what they do is projects just like this. For the state to think that they can do it without those partnerships or having the 50% control, I think is a big mistake. So, quite frankly, the partnership seems to be working. We're in alignment. There's markets that are interested in our gas. And if we just keep moving on the same pace within less than a decade, we're going to have gas to market, and it's going to be estimated $3 to $4 billion a year into the state treasury, and that is going to be a big solution for all of our financial calamities here.
And Mr. Sullivan, yep. Moving now to rural energy, mm-hmm. Would the 20% of royalties in the governor's gas legislation be enough to bring that gas from the corridor to western Alaska? And how would you bring gas to southeast Alaska?
Well, the good thing about Southeast Alaska is because of the wonderful investments they made in hydropower a number of years ago, they're not really looking for a whole lot of natural gas, quite frankly. There is some expansions of hydro that are needed, some interties, and there may be some communities that could use compressed natural gas. One of the things you can do at Tidewater is you can actually compress natural gas, which makes it very easily shipped by barge to coastal communities, either through Southwest or through Southeast. And then in the offtake points, whether it's Fairbanks or points north, the river system is ideal for shipping either propane or compressed natural gas down the river system. So having the big diameter gas line really creates opportunities throughout Alaska. But Southeast in particular is probably the one area where they're rich with hydro, and probably we're all a little bit envious of the cheap rates they're paying down there with the Snedishin Dam and the others.
So Southwest Alaska, which depends heavily on diesel, yeah. With that small of a customer base, would 20% of royalties after paying the permanent fund be enough to really build the infrastructure to get that liquefied and turn into propane and ship barge down the Yukon, up the Cusco?
Sure, I think so, because number one, shipping by barge is how they get their diesel fuel now anyway, so using barges is not unusual. Converting traditional diesel burning systems into natural gas or propane systems is a fairly easy conversion.
And a cost-effective one?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the cost of either the gas or the propane will be significantly cheaper than burning fuel oil.
And Mr. Mullock, what's your plan for delivering that gas to Southwest Alaska and Southeast Alaska?
Well, we do need the large diameter pipeline. We do need the takeoff points that allow for gas where it's economic to be transferred by additional pipe or by other means to markets. It is significantly cheaper. The 20% that you mentioned, if all of the forecasts are near right, will be a significant amount of money. And if we focus properly, and again, if we act very smartly, we can significantly reduce the cost of energy for electricity and home heating in particular across our state.
And in the years before there's ever gas flowing down that pipeline, do you have an interim strategy, or your running mate have an interim strategy for those years?
Well, certainly what Governor Walker will do will be to declare a state emergency in the high cost of energy, and will focus the state's efforts in a way that hasn't been done yet as a high priority to incentivize opportunity, to work with those many communities that are looking at alternative energy across our state, to look at how we can use our current oil flow in order to help reduce costs, because it is an immediate crisis. It is not a crisis that can wait for the completion of a large diameter pipeline in order for us to meet it.
And if we're at the mercy of a global fuel market and global fuel prices, are there things that you can do in the meantime with the revenue outlook that we have that would help rural Alaska in the short term?
Well, certainly maximizing alternative energy opportunities. PCE needs to continue to be funded. We need to look at how possibly the value of the PCE fund can be used in a possibly marginally broadened way. We need to look at every opportunity, and that's what we will do.
We're doing quite well on time. The candidates, I haven't had to enforce the time limits. So
not too bad.
So we do have a little extra time. I would like to ask, both of you are lieutenant governor candidates, but you will be part of the cabinet and involved in discussions. If you were to prioritize the large projects that are currently being proposed for Alaska, as we discussed earlier, we have declining oil revenues. How would you prioritize, and I'll start with you, Mr. Malott, you have a minute to respond to this. How would you prioritize the large projects that we have? We're proposing a Kinnick Arm Bridge. We've talked about the gas line, the road to Juneau. There's also the Susitna-Watonna Dam.
Certainly.
Prioritize those projects for
us. Well, they are among a range of projects. These are either half-billion or multi-billion dollar projects, and certainly their cost and their ultimate benefit to our state need to be continually analyzed, and we will do that. All of those projects need to be on the budget decision table. It's important that, at least for me, if the village of Kwithluk has a bridge project that is hugely important to that village, that it get the same scrutiny and the same level of public policy analysis as the bridge across the inlet, for example. I'm not saying that they are in any way equal, but their importance to the people involved and possibly the future of those communities is crucial. So projects across the state, particularly the infrastructure projects, need to be carefully analyzed.
And if you had to prioritize those projects, can you think of a way in which you would do that?
Well, I think that projects that are multi-billion need to be particularly carefully analyzed in the light of our state's revenue circumstance. As oil prices continue to decline, revenues to the state continue to decline. We need to be careful about investment in very large projects. I'm not saying that they don't have merit, but they also need to continue to be analyzed.
What would be the first priority on your list?
I would look at all of them.
All right. Mr. Sullivan, if you, as part of the cabinet, were to prioritize the large projects that are the state's considering and at a time of declining revenue, how would you do that? How would you list them?
Well, I'm hoping that as part of the cabinet, the governor will let me make all those decisions. So it's in prioritizing, one of the things you look at is what is the economic return, of course, and the gas line has to be number one. We can't lose momentum now on the natural gas pipeline. It's going to take literally many millions of dollars more to get to the stage where the big investment decisions are made. We cannot stop that momentum, which is why, again, we need to have Mr. Walker drop that lawsuit up at Point Thompson, because that's a roadblock to that. I also look at the Kinnickarn Bridge and Toll Authority. It's now in the Department of Transportation. It's not going to be a private-public partnership. And I think it's an essential road. You've got the two most populated areas of the state, Mat-Su and Anchorage, with one connection. And every winter, it happens that there's an accident or a natural occurrence where the road is blocked and 18,000 commuters are blocked from getting home. You build that bridge, there'll be tens of thousands of new homes, which means thousands of carpenters and plumbers and electricians and roofers and landscapers. And then there's businesses to serve those 10,000 of homes. And then there's suppliers that have to supply those businesses. The economic, I think, impact of just that bridge alone would be significant.
All right.
I have a third one, too, Port of Anchorage. It's got to get fixed. It's a lifeline for the whole state.
Thank you. We are coming close to the end of the hour in lieu of closing statements. Alexandra has one more question. Maybe we might extend that to two. We'll see. You will have a minute to respond. Alexandra?
Mr. Malott, the current governor took office after his predecessor, Sarah Palin, resigned. If you were appointed governor midterm, how would a Malott administration distinguish itself?
It would look very much like the Walker administration. But it would be an administration that would continue to reach out and engage with Alaskans so that their voice is heard, so that their role in public policy decision-making is clear, and that Alaskans know that their government listens, that it hears, and that it heeds their voice.
And Mr. Malott, in that event, what would your top three policy priorities be?
I'm sure Mr. Walker will have made substantial progress. I would continue his work, but again, education, the energy crisis, and dealing with the state fiscal crisis would, I'm certain, be continuing priorities.
And Mr. Sullivan, if you were suddenly propelled to the office of governor, how would your administration look?
Well, one of the beauties of working with Governor Parnell is that we're aligned on so many issues that I don't think you'd see a huge amount of difference. And we're aligned not only on the questions you've asked today about the fiscal concerns, energy concerns, education matters, but on social issues as well. And I think that's where there'd be a disconnect between the Walker-Malott ones, because I don't think they're aligned on particularly some of the social questions that are facing our country and our state. And they do come up every session. I mean, you can't avoid it. I know Mr. Walker had mentioned that he's not going to be involved in social issues. You just can't avoid it. And that's one of the, I think, the things about the alignment between Governor Parnell and myself is that I just can't think. I know of one issue where maybe we have a slight disagreement, but for the most part, I think I follow his philosophy and his leadership, and I think I'd be a good advocate for continuing his policies.
And Mr. Sullivan, where is that disagreement?
I don't support increasing the minimum wage.
And Mr. Sullivan, what would your top three policy priorities be in that event?
Well, again, your top priority always has to be making sure that you're economically sound, and you have to make sure that you're a safe community. Anybody, whether it's a mayor or a governor, public safety's job number one. You can't have quality of life in a community if you don't feel safe in a community. So again, the work the governor's done with doubling the village public safety officers and his domestic violence intervention programs have all been testament to his commitment to that. I would continue those commitments.
We have just a little bit of extra time, so I would like to ask, there's not a lot of money in this race, but we've seen a tremendous amount of money flood into the races across the state. Mr. Sullivan, in 45 seconds, if you were going to change that, if you were going to propose change to what we're seeing now with money coming into the state, more than $50 million, spent on the Senate race, what do you think about the amount of money that's in campaign spending now?
Well, I think Byron and I would agree that they need to send some of that our way for our lieutenant governor campaigns. It would just equalize things a bit. But, you know, the law is what it is. The Supreme Court has ruled on, you know, the ability of corporations to contribute. You know, it kind of makes you wish you had an ad agency this year because you'd be doing really, really well. But, you know, again, as long as the law reads as it does and you've got a Supreme Court decision that backs it up, I don't think I really have the power to change any of that. Is it irritating? Yes. But that's the way our system works.
And Mr. Ballot, what are your thoughts about the amount of money being spent on campaigns currently in the state?
Well, it is obscene to begin with. Just think of what good we could do with the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent. I also believe that the Supreme Court decision allowing corporations and unions to essentially be considered as citizens under our federal constitution and be able to spend as freely as they do over time needs to be curtailed. I think our country will do that.
This does conclude Public Broadcasting's 2014 debate for the state for Lieutenant Governor. Our thanks to our candidates and the panelists for participating. Please stay with us for the next hour as debate for the state continues with candidates for governor.